Mr. Robinson, Real 8. We were talking about how you were interviewed for a possible commission while you were at RAF Yatesbury. This would be getting on for December 1945. What happened then?
And then I suddenly called to the City League commanding officer. Someone dug me out of the snow. I was digging out around the aircraft. We were trying to get some aircraft started that were being snowed in and turn the propellers, which they had to go regularly to suck the fuel in and whatnot. And I thought, I'd forgotten all about this interview virtually. I thought, well, that's, you know, giving them up as nothing. I walked in the seat upstairs after and he said, congratulations, you've been awarded a commission. I was not an award, I don't know what the expression is, but you can be posted straight to leave the camp whenever you can now. We're going to offer training, although we do the commission this way it works in the Air Force, you get commission first and you go to training afterwards. I don't think it works like that now, but in those days, that's how we do it. I thought rather strange, rather. We're going to our reception here, where it's the Air Crew Officer School. And then we'll see you beforehand to get your kit. And you'll be given £50 and clothing coupons to go and get the equipment. They're really right together, they're all the same. But quite like all the experience and we've been various leaf kits and places to go and this sort of thing. And there's one other chap with me at the same time who was leaving. In total, out of 100 people on the course that make the same time, three of us were being commissioned. Very low percentage amongst the wives, so there aren't that many, most of them kept their sergeants. And we were both going on leave, and I went home with this gigantic princely sum of £50, and so I went to try and find out how much it actually cost. And I realised that I seen the first machine which we had trained, which was Austin Reeves, from the cap down, was the prime suppliers of military equipment. And when I went to the other course, I thought I'd try and do everything in one go, not knowing. I had no idea what prices were. And because when we said, all we can give you is the main uniform, we can't give you a break coat because we haven't put some away for those to be made, and we can't get it back in time for when you want it. And the shirts, we haven't got your size. And the shoes, I thought the shoes aren't good anyway, just the only kind of shoes I had to be. So all I got from was the main best blue, so to speak, and the cap. The best blue cost £12 probably, as I remember really. I forget how much the cap was, but it seemed quite absorbent compared with the uniform to me. I bore in mind the fact that all of these things were made to specifications, so therefore where you went, you get the same from the taxes. Things aren't quite like that. I went to Jeeves. Which is now on the side of the road, but it wasn't that time, it was in Leeson Street, and I got two shirts from them. The problem was a great coat. The only place I could get that was Burton's, and that was £8. It was quite salesman and lasted for some years after the war, actually. And I thought, well, I need to buy one. Because when we went back to the aircraft officer school, they're on the premises, well, all these tailoring firms and equipment firms coming every week in the officer's mess to sell you stuff. So I managed, we've been a little bit of time to get the rest of it. You had to have certain bits of equipment for various parades and functions and everything else you expected to do. And for the first time, when I got to Hereford, for the first time, I was introduced to a new lifestyle, the life of which I never even imagined, perhaps.
It was the Air Crew Officers School. Did they have a number or anything, or were you in a squadron or anything at it?
They were in a unit of some sort. Yeah, they were in what was called number 31 course, A Wing, number 2 squadron, A Flight. Usual, you make sure you're given to.
And it was just the Air Crew Officers School.
That's all it was in those days.
Now, you were saying, sorry I interrupted, you were introduced to a new lifestyle.
A new lifestyle of an officer, that's the life of which I've never been in before. The waitress service which seemed a bit strange in a military institute, so to speak, and rules and regulations, which were quite different to, as I say, again, much more stringent in a way, because one false move, you know, a commission could be taken away from you, not like an airman being posted away. If you did something wrong or made a false move, you'd be posted away and find yourself in another job or in another camp. Here, you can leave your commission and reduce the ranks at the top of the hat, if they don't ever feel like that. And my first day there, was a bit strange. I saw all these knives and forks arranged around the place, wondering what, which ones I was to use for which. I had no idea, sort of stuff, really. And I just watched what the people at the head would say for what we were doing. The thing that struck me initially, I thought it was a temporary thing, but those officers there who were actually former regular Air Force people weren't very keen on the chaps like myself who were promoted from the ranks. There was that was sort of distinction. It wasn't shown at first, it wasn't mentioned, but later on it became pretty evident that they were more, RAF Volunteer Reserve, or, you know, what sort of commission have you got, came into it. And that irritated me a little bit, really. I thought, that's what's that going to do? I think you're all doing the same thing. Anyway, the food suddenly changed from steak kidney pudding to some what seemed to be smaller quantities of other unimaginable, unidentifiable bits of food. Very good, very nice, and we asked, would you like some more? So all this, all suddenly treated with a different reverence, if you like, really, by the staff. You know, yes, sir, no, sir, all this sort of stuff was a little bit irritating. And we were there to air crew, and I thought, the chaps we're going to be with for our crew, and eventually I get to one, won't all the officers will be, mostly sergeants perhaps. I might be the only one until we'll be out of place, or at the time that wasn't the case, but this, you felt this, I felt this initially as an air crew to me, you all should be in the same rank, perhaps. You're all doing the same thing, you're all in the same situation, same problem. But anyway, I wanted to be like that, so I had to pull up with this officer's mess stuff where you have to pay for the service that was given to you, it turned out, which I hadn't anticipated. My monthly pay had gone up, or weekly pay had gone up, to £1 a day, which from 3 shillings, or by that time about 3 and 6 or a sergeant's pay as well, about 5 shillings a day. It's about to £1 a day, which seemed a princely sum until you started to pay out in the officer's mess fee.
What sort of fees would you have to pay?
Well, it depends. If you drank in the bar, you don't pay for it in cash, it goes on your account, so you never knew how much you're paying. Not that that bothered me at that time. You have to pay a set fee for the use of the mess. It wasn't very much, but it added £1 a day, £7 a week, but probably a couple of pounds a week, maybe, just to stand into it, something like that. If we had, we were allowed to have a batsman, kind of thing, which was a little bit strange to me. And here, this camp, because of the nature of the camp, we couldn't have batsmen, too many of us to want it. We were still in huts again, not in officers' quarters. And so with this, that's 10 of us in a hut as opposed to 30, slightly smaller huts. And so instead of a batman, they've got a batting allowance. That's 3 shillings a day in lieu of a batman, which I thought was a better bet than having a chap on my shirt for me. Later on, it changed a bit. But here, it was some helping to run. And we had a drill sergeant. We still had to do drill and all this sort of a different nature. You're now, instead of with a group, part of a group, you're in the front of it. It's all those on the etiquette of being an officer. And we were all addressed by the sergeant as gentlemen. You know, gentlemen needs the right turn stuff. And he was allowed to, he said he was allowed to tell us off. He would do in front of anybody, as he would do on parade with the girls. He was allowed to carry on as if we were airmen, virtually, and just joined, except that he just prefixed everything with the word gentleman, which it's a bit strange, really. And we learnt there all the things I thought we ought to know about our responsibilities, how if, for instance, we were officer commanding a station or unit, if we had to deal with some offender, a drunken person, and this sort of thing, what sort of attendance we can give them, or fine in drunken cases. The limits, according to rank, the limits, our limits up to flight of turn won't be the same, because automatically after 6 months as a pilot officer, as we were there, he became a flying officer. That was nothing wrong. You became a flying officer, and it was, you found all this information out in the government documents that used to be issued, what we called the government poll in the station office. And we've been told that you should be a flying officer by now, go and check it up, and I think the documents go on, I think it'll be. And so we've been a flying officer after 6 months, on a flight of turn automatically after 2 years as an officer, no more 18 months in other words. So in those days, that's how the thing. After that, it was by promotion only, and by what we were doing, the job we had, and labour, etc. And so, for a month of the first 6 months, we were on this course, being told all this sort of stuff, and the powers of arrest, the powers of if you were in that position, court martial procedures. All the stuff pertaining to being also what your duties would be in certain particular instances of trade, type social trades and that sort of stuff. As it turned out, at the very junior ranks, you're hardly called upon to do any of this stuff, because it's mostly senior people that do this. And as far as the legal side is concerned, there's a definite laid out rules to actually want someone to advise them, all of that sort of thing. You just have to know the limits. What you basically had to do was behave yourself, set a good example. The other side requirement was the so-called leadership qualities you had to demonstrate. They were put into difficult situations and showing how to get out of them, or trying to show them how you would get out of them.
Can you give us any examples of those?
Yes, one prime example is the assault courses, which we had those all throughout the affairs. So-called sort of courses, but this one was a one design where I said it was a dual purpose one, where not only would it teach you initiative and that sort of stuff, but it might help if you were able to shut down and found yourself in a strange country, in other words, getting back to somewhere you want to get back to. And so we were looking as much an assault course as we've already done the basic assault courses over and wrote some all this sort of stuff. But here, we're taking out of the country and drop there, give them a compass. And so finally, well, that's the camp. We're trying to deal with them. And we weren't told beforehand what we have to do. We had no idea. We're supposed to think of all these things in advance, really. We're done in groups of two of us. Groups of two, and we've got tons of different places. And they told us that on the way back, in the last half mile, you'll be fired at the right ammunition, but above your heads. But just to show you what sort of thing you might have to put up with. When it pitch dark in a strange countryside, this will sound a little bit familiar. We were dressed in the PT kit, denims and boots thing, which was the a signal of a nasty activity. And we were given just this compass and told, well, get yourself back to the camp. And if you're not back in a certain time, we'll come and look for you. And so this chap and I really discussed how we were going to get back to the chap I've never seen before, and he's running from the town. And we discussed how we're going to get back to camp the best way. And we'd already had some idea where it was, why we direction we were going in the truck, although we couldn't see out, we were covered up, but it's a vague idea which direction we argued about it for a bit, and then in that direction, we went across a field, full of carapaces and bullet holes, whatever, so we've got to pick those up and bring them on. And then we had a movement ahead of us, or it was bent down, laid down, and a sheep wandered up and had a lamb in front of us. Just there and then, language I've never seen before, of course. Just, well, as I was never into you, it was like that happening. And we just out the soul, it was noon now, but yeah, we could see this all happening. And we bumped into cows that were long, we met with the commissary, we had to climb through and eventually got back to the last bit of that, and then once we knew the guns were firing at you were getting quite close, so about half a mile or something away. We were in the right direction, that was the idea of it. But the forest is fairly high, you didn't hear it, it was pretty safe. And the last bit was a bit of a salt course, we had to jump over a little 15-foot-high-foot wall, which didn't sort of have to do, and I found it a little bit tricky, but I was still there, because there was a ledge halfway up, if you go onto that, you go up over there, and things like that, so things to crawl through, sort of thing you see everywhere. And the last minute you fire off five rounds into something, and someone standing there will stop pushing, taking them out with a clipboard and all that stuff, and saying, well done, that man, all that sort of stuff. And that was the final thing. But before all that, I was just going back and backtracking a little bit on one assault course that I found a little bit of it was where I had to cross a stream, quite a wide stream, a boat with two parallel ropes. The idea that between trees, the idea was we climbed up, still on one rope, reached up to the other one, went hand over hand, away with foot, across the stream. With a rifle on the back, or tin helmet, a big pack on the back, this sort of stuff. And I found that I couldn't reach the top rope. So I can't reach the top rope. So I said, go hand over hand on the bottom rope. Throw your rifle across first, and go hand over hand with the bottom rope. And get that way, that's the way it's going, that's quite acceptable. So all that seemed to be going on around me, so I went to throw my rifle across, and the strap of it just caught the side of another pack I was wearing there, and the rifle did a semicircular movement and fell plop into the water, the river. So I said, so I'm going to get my rifle, so I said, no, leave it there, and just go across, and then get your rifle in. So okay, so I went hand over hand, got up on the waist of the packs and everything on me. There was so much I couldn't hold on the rope any longer. I had to let go of it and it straight into the stream right by the rifle. You would pick it up and bring it out now. And it goes all the collapse up and all this, like it was sheer weight of it. And I just had the strength to hang on to this. Like, if I could have done it hand over hand, I said, obviously I've got all the rope you can do the two. So that was one disadvantage I had there for doing this. But this final assault course seemed to work out okay. And, this was the final thing at this place. There were one or two other things we had in the gymnasium that we had to do, which the familiar things that one sees nowadays of so-called leadership quality things, but it never really...
What kind of thing?
Well, mostly climbing around on ropes and stuff and getting across distances which look insurmountable at first, but then you find an easy way of doing it. And, we've got this sort of thing so many times at various places, and what time we've got to hear, you knew what we said before, it wasn't nothing to the same.
How did you get on with your fellow officers?
Well, quite well, really, I think, because they were all from different. There's only one chap from the camp, and the others were all of different disciplines, pilots, navigators, and all sorts. One or two of them. I've been, several have been in operations and muscular aircraft, this sort of stuff. And so there's quite a mixture of people there. One of them, the Queen's Flight, and all those sort of things, or Queen's Flight, and those things. And so they're quite varied. And the nationalities, Australian, Canadians, this sort of thing. So it was quite riotous at times, really, with all this mixture of people. And very enjoyable, really. It's like we're all in the same boat, all trying to do the right thing. In fact, in another group that was there, one party they had, they started throwing billiard balls around, smashed several windows in the mess, down to the table, the next morning found ourselves on the train going home and having been reduced to the ranks. It's like, oh, there's no mucking about, there's never any mucking about in, once you're in that situation, the commission situation, you've got to follow the rules even more so. You found that out, but it didn't accept you from doing certain things. You've got to do absolutely real much more closely than if you were in the ranks.
Did you drink at all by then, or had you started?
I started to drink then, not much so, because we were told in our training that alcohol, therefore, when it comes to flying at altitude, the alcohol consumption is very similar to oxygen lack. And I've seen the effects of oxygen lack, but I saw even more so later on that it's just bad, you know, and therefore, you won't be able to have a drink if you're flying. There's no flying here, of course, so therefore, we couldn't drink if we wanted to. And Hereford wasn't a bad town to go into, but I didn't do that very much again. I chummed off the real chap who was a King Snooper, and was his uncle who was Joe Davis, so we came on a sneaker. And he told me all about the family, really, how all of them were. His mother was world champion women's sneaker, brother at one time, the sea stuff, and they were all the family played sneaker, and they danced and everything else. So, I beat him once at that sniper, that's it. Only once, and he let me beat him, just for the record. But generally, we had quite a good time there. I remember, again, not knowing where we were going to at the end of it, all kinds of different places.
Now, your training had been going on for, getting on for a year then, you know. Were you keen, I mean, the war was also... not coming to an end exactly, but certainly showing signs of coming to an end. Were you wanting to get into it? I mean, how did you feel about the whole prospect of active service and the rest of it at the time?
Whether I actually got on to active flying and actually drop bomb, I began to think about it a bit then and thought that's not a very good idea, really. And providing you hit the target, if you're going to be sure you're going to do that each time, and the target is a military objective, fine, I would be happy with that. But no, it hurts me a bit. Kelly wasn't here, but there's a fact that there might be people working on it. And it sort of thing worried us all a bit, really. We thought, we tend to think, well, it's not quite ethical, really, if you like. We admit war isn't anymore. And everybody in those days was saying, well, you've got to give it back to them a little bit. The morale was getting a bit better, but it was still a bit on the low side. And there was still this, go and give it to them, chap stuff. Or, they're bombing London right now, let's go and do something over there.
Did you discuss your feelings with other people? Because, I mean...
Yeah, we all do, actually. We all thought about it quite a lot, really. But, of course, I suppose, naturally enough, our own survival in trying to do what we're trying to do was an importance as well. We're really, trying to think of ways of making that a bit healthier. But, no, I mean, one has to say, I suppose, that we're all volunteering to do this, knowing, we're still knowing, or must have known what the livelihood was and doing what we're doing. And, but never crossed the line until a bit later on, probably more strongly, when it came to doing operational training, we suddenly realised what you're actually going to do.
Would you have done it? I mean, do you...
I think so. I don't know, really. I was trying to prove to myself, I think, that I could do a job that someone a bit bigger than I could and could do the same thing without worrying. I feel like I was doing a man's job as a boy, really. But I thought it was that way.
Were you nervous at all?
Of course, yeah. Especially doing flying. I used to think every time, this might be the last one. Something might go wrong with it. Until we're in the end, and one time we're doing something, it goes off that curve.
But were you nervous about the prospect of, I mean, say, flying over Germany?
Oh, yes. Anything. I'm very nervous about that, of course. No doubt about that. I'll be resigned to it because I couldn't find someone and say, I don't want to do this. No one could do that. You could, I suppose, be taken offline for medical reasons. But the people were taken off also, of course, various medical problems. Like people in the Barney, in the Morse code, basically. found themselves in a, not in my own sense of the sound, but there was a, they reckon there was a ward there in the hospital. These chaps, all got a bit fussy, struggling to get his coat. There's another chap there who was without a key, without a Morse key. His wrist was going up, down as if he was sending Morse code, but worse than that, the chap there passing it down. I'm not sure that that was the right story or not, really, but these sort of stories throw about the working away who were Morse code didn't actually affect them. I'd never put down to that. It may be other stresses as well, as you know, today, and it might, so it might be enough entirely.
Now, as you got to the end of the course, were you assessed in any formal way?
We're given written exams, that and the usual sort of thing.
Now, what were these exams in? Was that in the sort of roles of the officer?
All the things that we've been, all the legal side and all that, and the discipline side that was different again, and the role of officers or opposed to the other ones, or any conjunction of or whatever. Yeah, the main thing was to teach us how to behave properly, how to demonstrate to other people that we're not quite as bad as we might be painting. But I know some too many people who don't want that too. And things like that, and the legal side, all these things, we've learned about the role of commissioning mates, which is a bit different, and how you're expected to behave and how you're expected to demonstrate to other people what the right things to do. Now, it's a lovely theory, of course, but in practice, we all know these things don't quite work out that way. But by and large, it was a teaching of King's regulations and that sort of thing. So, reference to that, which we had to know, not so much of it, but where to find things. And I've long since forgotten most of this stuff.
And you passed this.
Well, yes,
did everybody pass that? I mean,
it's not so much passing as you've completed it. I don't think there was a. There could have been a failure if you were desperately up the creek on it, but generally, I think most people moved on to what level we're going. We're told we're going, we're still home on leave again, and told that our next port of call will be an advanced flying school. In some cases, they went to other parts. And attached things, but those of us who were in the stage where I was, it's all advanced flying school, and we can't tell you where it is at the moment, but there are many of them, and as it so turned out, I was given one to go to in Bishop's Court, that's two, in two words. I almost thought it was one word, but I found that recently it's two words actually.
But where's that?
Which is in a place called Ardglass, A-R-D-G, Douglas. In Northern Ireland. It's about 30 miles from the pub in the coast, and about some distance from Belfast, I have there.
And you went out there, I think it says here February 1945, would that be right?
Yes, that's right. And the experience there, when we were given awards to move somewhere, we were sent to a railway signal. Because here I started traveling first class and off the so therefore that made things a little bit more comfortable. And I was given a warrant to go and get a railway ticket to this place, Ardglass, in Northern Ireland. That's the nearest station where we picked up the trains to the town. I went to Hounslow station with this warrant. I don't know, I would have gone to a mainline station, so I went to the Hounslow. And they just checked this down and said, can you give me a ticket to Ardglass in Northern Ireland? Yes, sir, it's no problem at all. Okay, and wrote out a ticket for me there and then in halfway hand to Ardglass. It didn't query where it was or what it was or I thought it was very strange. And I got to, one thing I hadn't paid it for was the idea that the distance involved in going there. You had to go up the train to Lyme in Scotland and go across to Belfast from there. Oh, not to Belfast, to Lyme to Strang. That's what. A train to Stranraer in Scotland, and then across to Ardglass from there in the ferry, and then a train from there down to Downpatrick, changed another train to Ardglass. That was a branch line. And I got to Euston Station, actually.